So you get like these very distinct overheated spikes at the end of the cycle. That's showing you, yeah, like the marginal buyer and seller are way out of proportion bidding up price compared to what the underlying capital flowing in is saying. That's probably a good time to consider, you know, taking some chips off the table.
Hey guys, crazy episode coming up with one of the best on-chain metrics guys out there right now. But before we jump into the episode, I want to give a shout out to the Digital Asset Summit. For those who don't know, Blockworx's flagship conference is coming back after about an 18-month COVID hiatus. So for anyone who's interested in the institutional crypto space, this event is at Cipriani, New York City. We rented out the entire venue in New York, September 14th and 15th. We're capping the event at, I think it's around 500 or 600 attendees. Ticket prices increase this Friday. You're listening to this on Thursday. You've got 24 hours to go buy your ticket before ticket prices increase. Google Digital Asset Summit Blockworx, or just head over to blockworx.co, go to the events section, and go buy your ticket. All right, enjoy the episode. This episode is brought to you by Luca Tax and Exodus. Stay tuned for more info. All right, we got Will Clemente here down in North Carolina. How you doing, Will?
I'm chilling. I'm enjoying this warm weather here. Just taking it easy. I finished up my job at Target, man, so I'm just chilling. Looking at a lot of charts.
Nope. Yeah, you went from Target, and you're still in college, right? Still at ECU?
Yeah, I go to East Carolina University, which is about an hour and a half east of Raleigh, kind of more towards the coast. I just finished my sophomore year.
Nice, man. So how come? How did you? Well, you're 19 or 20 or 21, I'd assume. How did you go from working at Target, sophomore in college, to you got like 100,000 people following you to determine where the price of Bitcoin's going to go next week?
Yeah, so I think when I had first turned 18 last year, I was like, oh, this is cool. You know, I can take advantage of all these stocks that are cheap when we hit the big liquidity crunch. But I'm not somebody where I like to just go in blind to what I'm doing. I like to kind of understand it before I just dive into it. So I just listened to a bunch of podcasts, and I kind of fell for the whole, you know, value investing, Warren Buffett style, like free cash flow based investing. I thought that was like very logical, but you know, long story short, and Preston Pish talks about this all the time, but you realize you're trying to make calculation on these different companies, but you're assuming that there's sound money there. And so, you know, coming to that realization, which makes sense why values underperformed, you know, momentum and growth over the last 10, 15 years, that kind of led me down the rabbit hole of, okay, so if the problem is the money, you know, what is the solution? And then obviously that led to Bitcoin eventually. I think I took my, you know, I was captivated by Bitcoin throughout all of my summer. I was working at Whole Foods over the summer, and I remember like all my paychecks, I was putting them actually into altcoins, which I know the Bitcoiners are going to kill me, but I got caught up in the whole DeFi thing because I didn't know what I was doing to the extent that I do now. So I think a lot of that kind of distracted me and pulled me in. But then, you know, after I got burned pretty bad, I realized, you know, okay, let me sit down and really grok this. This crypto world, there's not a lot of like formal education or books on this stuff. Like, you really just need to kind of get hands-on experience by listening to people in the space. And so I just kind of went on like a rampage of listening to a bunch of podcasts from all the people that seemed like they were the smartest folks in the space. And then it was just Bitcoin only. And I've just kind of hyper-focused on that then. I think I bought my first little sliver of Bitcoin in like late August of last year. And then, you know, as far as getting into like the on-chain stuff, that was more towards, I don't know, I guess January. I was listening to this pod that Peter McCormick did with Willy Woo, and you know, it was after we had this big drop, and I was, you know, trying to make sense of it, and the way that he described everything I thought was really fascinating, because it's basically like he could see under the hood and explain everything and fundamentally like the behavior of what people are doing on the blockchain. And so to me, that really was interesting, because you know, you have technical analysis, which is just the traditional way of kind of like monitoring price action and the strength, momentum of price action. But the on-chain stuff, you're actually looking at the fundamental behavior of the investors on the blockchain. So it's like if you could, you know, see everybody transacting cash, and you could see all that on a public ledger. So anyway, that was really neat to me. And then since then, it's just been pretty much nonstop, just consuming a bunch of content on that. And just, you know, I got into Glassnode about a month or two ago, and from there it's just been, you know, looking at a lot of their stuff all day long, and in combination with a couple other things, but mostly Glassnode.
Nice, man. Yeah, off to the races. So I want to dive right into the details and some of the data that you're seeing, but real quick, so can you kind of explain for the audience, for those who don't know, what on-chain metrics are? Because it's kind of this unique thing that exists in our industry, and we've got a lot of folks listening to the podcast who don't actually work in crypto. So if you could kind of explain, like, traditional equities, I used to trade FX currencies, you've got, you know, Fibonacci numbers, and you've got the 200-day moving average. We still have that in crypto, but what do we have that kind of traditional equities markets don't have?
Yeah, so I think, you know, with traditional assets, you're looking at a lot of technical analysis, which is, you know, looking at different moving averages, you know, kind of like looking at how price usually tends to revert to certain means, like the 200 day you had mentioned, you know, the 50, the 20, all you know, some of these key moving averages people look at, but then also technical stuff. You have like the MACD, the MACD. You have the RSI, which is looking at kind of the strength and kind of momentum of the price. You have these different price analysis that is purely looking at the action and movement of the price. But what's interesting to kind of the and this isn't just Bitcoin. There is some on-chain analytics for other cryptocurrencies as well. But you know, we have everything is on a blockchain, so you like the information, anything that happens on the blockchain is publicly, you know, available for anybody who runs a node in Bitcoin. So, you know, if anybody wanted to, they can just plug in their node and then extract data and then kind of make interpretations based off of the data that is from the blockchain. And that data can't be manipulated at all. It is what, you know, what it says, right? Because, like, this is... it's not open for interpretation. The data is what it is. So I think that it's a really interesting tool where you can kind of look at different cohorts or, you know, separate different clusters of coins, maybe based on the age that they've been in wallets. So perhaps looking at people who are more experienced in the market, looking at the size of the wallets, you know, what are small investors doing versus big money. And then, you know, you can take different ratios of things to kind of understand, you know, how is the behavior? Because at the end of the day, any kind of really analysis you're doing on something is just looking at human behavior. So you're saying, okay, you know, what is the human behavior of these different cohorts? How is that, you know, affected Bitcoin's price in the past? Which, granted, you know, we still have a very small sample size. We only have two or three of these cycles to really compare to, so there is a little bit of guesswork in there. But I think, you know, at this point now, we have two of these full you know, greed and fear cycles, the bull and bear cycles, where we can kind of get a gauge of, okay, you know, based off of what the investors are doing on chain, this looks like perhaps it's overheated, and so maybe it's a good time to, you know, start to take some chips off the table. And then conversely, when you're in the bear market, you can get these, you know, zones, I guess you could say, of underheatedness, where, you know, Bitcoin historically has been very unsold at these levels. So, yeah, I think, you know, the technical analysis, which is used in traditional finance, is also partially used in Bitcoin, but adding that other layer of kind of fundamental analysis on what the market participants are actually doing, I think can help you get the full picture. But I think you do need to have some kind of mix between the two. I for a while I was just relying on solely the on-chain stuff, and I had missed that big original price drawdown that we had, where if you looked at some of the technicals, it perhaps would have hinted to a higher likelihood of something like that happening. So I think, you know, just utilizing as many tools as possible through both the on-chain and TA can kind of help you get the best possible picture.
Nice, man. So let's jump into it. What's some of the most interesting data that and charts that you're looking at today?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, like, one of the underlying behaviors of the whole cycle that everybody was talking about was the exchange flows. This whole narrative that, you know, the institutions were sucking supply off of the exchanges, there was going to be no Bitcoin left to sell. That kind of reversed, and which it was a historic drawdown that we had going for, you know, like 6 months there. But in the last month, we have kind of seen that revert back to trending up, where the balance on exchanges is now going up. But breaking that down, it seems like there is still a lot of buying on Coinbase, you know, spot buying on Coinbase. But when you look at something like Binance or Bitfinex, the balance is actually trending down. So I think some of that is going into derivatives. You know, you can only see stuff on chain. So, you know, once it goes onto the exchange, you don't know perhaps if it is going to derivatives or if it's going to spot. So that's something where perhaps I'd like to get some clarification. But the balance on Binance has been trending up, while Coinbase continues to trend down. But the amount of coins moving onto Binance has just overwhelmed the amount moving off of Coinbase. So we have this net increase at Bitfinex as well. Coins are moving on there. So are you saying
people are moving basically Bitcoin onto Binance and off of Coinbase? And when you say onto and off of, is that when you take coins off of Coinbase, are they primarily taking it into, like, putting it in cold storage, or are they selling it?
Yeah, so I think there is a little bit of a misconception that whenever coins are moved onto exchanges, they're going to be sold, and then when they're moved off exchanges, it's always people moving them into cold storage, which I think is kind of the underlying assumption. But I think there's a lot of that, but it's not 100% of what's going on. For example, like, you know, there's market makers that are moving in and out of exchanges all day long. People have to post, you know, collateral. You saw a lot of coins moving onto exchanges when we had that big dip down to, you know, 30K. But I think some of that was selling, but some of that was also people just posting up collateral. And then also we just touched on, you know, the derivatives. So some of those coins moving on to the exchanges that don't only offer spot, like Binance and Bitfinex, I think some of those coins are going to the futures contracts as well. But I think it's something you look at where kind of the broader trend of it, you know, following it day to day, it can get a little noisy. But when you zoom out and see that broader trend of, you know, especially looking at Coinbase, I think that really shows some strong U.S. likely institutional demand, because, you know, you've just continued to see their exchanges deplete since, you know, call it. It was right around all-time highs, actually, kind of mid-December. So that's interesting. But also looking at another metric, it's called a liquid supply. And I think this is a little more telling than just looking at the exchanges, the exchange flows. What Glassnode does is they can cluster different addresses together, and they say, okay, this group of addresses looks like one person, or like one, they call it an entity. So it looks like a person, it could be a corporate treasury, it looks like one entity on the blockchain. And so then they can kind of analyze the behavior of that entity and say, are, you know, on average, they only move a very, very small portion of their coins out of their holdings. So that address would be considered a liquid. And then the entities that are moving coins in and out all the time, they're considered liquid. So just looking throughout the whole cycle, you saw this consistent movement of coins in the hands of these illiquid entities. And it's just recently, over the last 2 weeks, that's flipped around. So I think that's something to keep an eye on for sure. you want to see people more of these liquid entities coming in and scooping up coins. Also, we need to see some larger entities coming in and scooping up coins, because you know, for the past month or so, retail's been stacking like super hard. I've never seen, you know, just looking at the historical chart, retail's never really been stacking Bitcoin, adding to their holdings as heavy as they have over the past month or so. But they've only added 8,000 coins, so it's like, the, you know, looking at the behavior of them, yes, they're stacking, but retail really doesn't have the power to sustain a almost $1 trillion asset at this point. So you are going to need some whales to come in, which, you know, looking at those larger cohorts, it looks like they've been trimming since last month. So that's one thing I'm looking for is to start seeing some of those bigger buyers come and step in.
Yeah. All right. There's a few things I want to break down. One is, let's start with the entities part. So you posted a chart a few days ago. You said 77% of BTC supply is illiquid in strong hands. At the same time, demand for Bitcoin, new users, is growing exponentially. Bitcoin price only has one way to go in the long term. So when you look at 77% of BTC supply is illiquid, what are you, those, is that that new entity stat? And like, why does that matter to you?
Yeah, so the 77% is just like we were just talking about how Glassnode clusters those addresses, looks at entities, and then looks at the behavior, the buying selling behavior of those entities. So of all the entities of all the supply, on the blockchain, 77% is held in those liquid addresses, which also can be just lost coins too, right? But a fair portion of that is just people with, you know, we call it diamond hands. But the other thing you were talking about, the entity growth, it's the same thing. You know, you're clustering the addresses together to look at entities, but what you're doing here is you're looking at the amount of new entities coming onto the blockchain over time. And so when you kind of plot that out, you get this very logarithmic looking curve throughout all of Bitcoin's existence. Whereas more Bitcoins have become a liquid over time, it's almost the same logarithmic looking curve throughout Bitcoin's all 12 years of Bitcoin's existence. So yeah, I think at the end of the day, that's when you're just looking at raw supply and demand, that may be the only pair of charts that you really need from a price standpoint, because you're seeing new demand come on logarithmically, and then at the same time, the amount of coins that are being pulled off that aren't going to be coming on to for sale is going up over time. So that's what that was.
All right, so if you have more folks, if you have more Bitcoin becoming illiquid, so Bitcoin's price is a function of supply and demand. So if the supply is becoming illiquid, right, and demand is going up, what's going on with the price? Why isn't the price going up?
Yeah, so like this trend is.
I feel like I'm like an old guy like shouting at you, Will. Like, why isn't the price going up, Will? Like,
you should see my Twitter feed, dude. you know, that's more of a broader trend, like over all Bitcoin's history. Actually, and we touched it at the very beginning, but like this illiquid address, illiquid metric, it's flipped the other way in the last couple weeks. So we've actually started to see a lot of liquid supply come back on. So that's actually that number. It's 76.7%. That's come down. It was at 78.6% about a month ago, which I saw Blockworks tweeted that. So I don't know if it was you who maybe had seen that, but yeah, it's come.
I don't
run
our Twitter
down.
Account anymore, but we got you.
Oh, okay. Appreciate it. But yeah, it's come down over the last month. So I think, you know, it's a broader trend with the more coins becoming liquid over supply. But when you kind of zoom in on like, you know, day to day, week to week basis, it can get a little noisy.
All right, guys, it's ad time. I'm gonna let you guys in on a little secret. There's one company that's powering a ton of the crypto data in the space. And by crypto data, basically there's all these companies, traditional financial institutions that need crypto data for, you know, accounting purposes, for tracking the value of their assets, for running audits, right? And so there's one company, they're called Luca, LUKKA. I've talked about them on the podcast before. They're powering some of the largest businesses in the world in both the crypto and traditional financial services space. They're the primary pricing source used by S&P Dow Jones indices for their new crypto index. So I wanted to just throw this out there. If you guys are any sort of business that needs to value crypto assets, create financial statements, perform any sort of normal accounting audit process, you guys should head on over. It's Luka, L-U-K-K-A, luka.tech, L-U-K-K-A dot T-E-C-H /empire, or just head over to luka.tech /empire. Tell them I sent you, they'll take care of you. Alrighty, let me know what you think. The other day I posted on Twitter, I said, who's the best entrepreneur? Who's the entrepreneur that everyone should know in crypto, but maybe doesn't know already, right? We're not talking like the mainstream, the super big folks. Who's the best entrepreneur that's kind of under the radar in crypto? God, post went crazy. Got like 300, 400 comments. There was one name that kept popping up, JP Richardson. JP Richardson at Exodus. So I thought, man, that's crazy. Exodus is one of our sponsors. Let me call him out, right? So JP Richardson, CEO of Exodus, done an amazing job building one of crypto's most loved apps. And there's a number of reasons. They got a mobile app. They got a desktop app. You can instantly exchange over 100 different currencies. They've got interactive charts. They're fully integrated with the Trezor hardware wallet, so you can always be secure. So if you're looking to buy crypto, if you're looking to just get away from just buying one or two currencies, you want to explore other things, go to exodus.com/empire or just search Exodus in the App Store or Play Store. Check them out. Shoot me a DM on Twitter. Let me know what you thought. Go follow JP Richardson. Go check out Exodus. All right, exodus.com/empire. So you right now you have whales. I'm trying to wrap my head around this. You've got whales selling and retail accumulating, but you also have a lot of the folks who were selling Bitcoin. They were kind of short-term coin holders. So people who started stacking maybe earlier this year when Bitcoin was at like 10 or 20K, they said, oh shit, I just made a 2 or 3X. Let me dump this stuff. Does this basically mean that young, like kind of there are newer whales who are selling and that older retail is accumulating? Is that, can you break that down for me?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that's right. That's what I'm seeing at least. So, you know, if we break that down into two parts, first of all, you have the size of the holdings of the cohort, and then you also have the age. So first of all, looking at the size, over the last month, I forget the exact number off the top of my head, it's about 160,000 BTC has been moved out of cohorts between 10 bitcoins and 100,000 bitcoins. Anything over 100,000 is pretty much an exchange. So between 10 and 100,000, because I think at this point, 10 bitcoins isn't necessarily retail. You know, we're talking upwards of $350,000 right now, almost $380,000. So I wouldn't necessarily consider that retail. So between 10 and 100,000 BTC. That's their holdings have trended down by almost 160,000 over the last month. At the same time, you have this kind of dichotomy where retail has added more BTC than they pretty much have in any other point in Bitcoin's history. They've added, I think it's a little over 8,000 BTC over the last month, which of course isn't offsetting the selling pressure from the larger cohorts. But so that's the size aspect and the retail I'm looking at .001 BTC to 10 BTC, and then looking at the age, so Glassnode separates these different entities or addresses into this threshold of it's 155 days. So statistically, if coins are held by someone for over 155 days, the likelihood, statistically, and this is where Glassnode comes in because they do all this hard work where I don't have to do any of this, and they figure out, okay, after this threshold, the likelihood of these coins being sold goes way down. And so that comes out to 5 months. So that's the cutoff for this threshold when we're talking about short-term or long-term. So what we've seen over the last, call it month or so, is the short-term holders have been selling off while the long-term holders have been accumulating that whole time, which you know, looking at you know, historical cycles, this is kind of weird behavior where usually what you see is you have this big price rally, and throughout that, the smart money, the money that's been in Bitcoin for a long time, they start to sell in as, you know, the exuberance kicks in, and all the unsophisticated, you know, retail money just steps in to try to ride the wave as Bitcoin kind of becomes very momentum driven. So you see this divergence of long-term holder holdings going down throughout the bull market as the amount of supply held by short-term holders goes up. So, you know, that speculators coming in. And then when we head into the bear market, that's when you start to see it go the other way, where then the shorter-term holders move out because Bitcoin isn't, you know, so exciting anymore. All the speculators move out. But the long-term holders then begin accumulating again. And so usually you have this very smooth line where, you know, peak bull market, it's peak holdings of short-term holders and the bottom of holdings for long-term holders, and then in the middle of the bear market, that's when you have peak holdings from long-term holders and the very bottom for that cycle of holdings from short-term holders. So my point I'm trying to get at here is, historically, we haven't seen this effect where halfway through the cycle, you have the longer term holders buying while the shorter term holders are selling off, which to me, the only other time that this kind of resembles is 2013 and kind of that consolidation between the double pumps, where you had this huge drawdown and then the longer term holders were like, hold on, this thing's not over. We're in the middle of a bull market here. I'll scoop up those cheap coins. Thank you very much. And they come in buying, and the short term speculators freak out and sell. So that's something I'm keeping an eye on for sure. You know, we're either in one of those big, you know, bull market consolidations, or we're heading into a bear market, just based off of the you know, the two trends in behavior from short and long term holders. But yeah, I see it. You know, the younger whales are selling off, and it seems like the old retail money that's been around for a long time, they're steadily accumulating, and so I think you do need to see some new whales step in, though, if we're going to start to see some big price action. Possibly, if we break out of this range that we're in, capital will start flowing in. So, like, we've been pretty much just chopping around between, you know, 32K and 40K for a while now. It's been almost 3 weeks or something like that. And so I think it's kind of just like no man's land where, if we break 32K, then it's pretty widely agreed upon that we're probably going a lot lower than that, just based off of multiple kind of support levels that we have set there, and also a lot of buys that are set there. So if those get broken through, then we might head into kind of the mid 20Ks. But at the same time, if we can break above, you know, 40K, 42K, you'll probably see the reverse effect to the upside, where, you know, perhaps a lot of the shorts have their stop set up there, and not only that, where, you know, money sitting on the side is looking for, okay, you know, I'd like to get a lower entry here. The price action looks kind of frothy, but if it breaks above this level, this kind of key resistance level, then I think it's safe to say that, you know, it's made its decision of where it's going. The momentum's back on its side to the upside, so I feel more comfortable taking a position here. I think that's the thought process of many.
So it kind of looks like the two main numbers that you're looking at are 32K is kind of that bear market support, that if it breaks through that support, you know, we might be headed lower, and then at 40K you've got that resistance line.
Yeah, I think if we break 32K, the likelihood of us going into the low 20s is pretty high. I wouldn't say we're going into a bear market if we break 32K. I would be looking for a bounce from if we break that level down to the mid to low 20s. And I would expect price to get bid up from there, and if not, then I would get a little concerned. But I don't think if we break 32K that we're necessarily not in a bull market anymore. But it looks like, you know, as of today, we're kind of on the edge of breaking 38,000, which there's a lot of sell orders there. So if we can chew through those, it looks like it's a pretty straight shot up there to 40K, which is that next, you know, big resistance level. And then if we can bust through that, I think you start to get a lot of momentum to the upside, possibly some shorts getting squeezed in there, and then it might be off to the races from there. But that's, you know, I'm always bullish, but if we can break through that 40, 42K level, I'll be super bullish again.
You're talking about 20K, man. You're going to get some people scared off here.
Yeah, I think that's the very least likelihood of the outcomes on the table.
Yeah. I'm sorry. RIP your DMs tomorrow when we launch this. Yeah, you're not the only person. I interviewed Dan Held. I had Dan Held on the show last week talking about the super cycle. And I think he was like really trying to cement in a lot of people's heads that a lot of folks came into the space in 2017 and that bull market looked a certain type of way, but that other bull markets haven't looked like that. Using, I think it was 2013 as an example, which is the same one that you used, where you kind of had that double bounce, right? So I don't know. It's interesting. And Novogratz was saying the same thing. He's like, look, we're probably in a pretty long period of consolidation here, a couple months maybe. And then, you know, he'd look for, you know, kind of edge to the upside. So I don't know. It's interesting to hear a few of you guys say this looks like 2013.
Yeah, we also have such a small sample size where, I mean, I do this all the time, like comparing the previous cycles, but how effective really is it if you only have two or three other samples? And we've never, it's always been retail.
We're wishing for something. We're trying to grab onto something, you know?
Yeah, we're coping.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, I do think the fact that this thing's always been retail driven, now that you have the institutions, the price structure might look a little bit different. And then also the fact that you have, you know, all this leverage in the derivatives market, I think that's really extending these price moves both to the up and downside, where, you know, we start coming down and then, you know, those longs getting liquidated, those people that aped in at 50K thinking the thing's going to the moon, you know, all those people getting liquidated on the way down, as you start to have some spot selling, I think that's really just like accelerating the moves and then to the upside as well. But like, that's what I think a lot of the price action over the last month or so has been, especially that last wick down to 30K was pretty much all liquidations.
Yeah. If we had to compare it to the 2013 bull run, how much longer do you think we consolidate around here before breaking out again?
Yeah, like just like running over some fractals and stuff, possibly till the end of the summer. But I don't think it's the end of the bull market. If it was, then we would have kind of not even come close to reaching previous levels of kind of greed and euphoria and overheatedness of multiple different kind of like indicators that assess, you know, the over underheated state of the market, of the like broader bull or bear cycle. So that would be very surprising to me. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I would be very surprised if that was the top. I think one other thing to consider is like the institutions are going to take you know, months to go from saying, oh, I'm interested in this, I think this is, you know, a good hedge against inflation, let's go ahead and start, you know, going through a process of taking a position. I mean, that could take months with all the regulatory shit that they have to go through. Sorry if I'm not supposed to curse. But it might not come till, you know, late summer, the fall. I mean, who knows? I'm just speculating. But it seems like, you know, even Saylor, who has the majority of the voting rights for his company, he was saying it took them months to go from saying, oh, we want to take a position to actually buying. So perhaps, you know, we see this consolidation and then you start to see this next wave of institutional demand coming in later this year. But I think it is important to note that, like, if we don't get some big buyers coming in, I guess that's obvious. But what I'm saying is, like, they can't be retail. We need institutional money. We need you know, investment grade capital coming into the space now, because you're looking at a, you know, $700-800 trillion asset right now. That's not going to really be driven by retail money.
Yeah, my favorite Michael Saylor story is someone asked him, I forget who it was, someone on like CNBC or something, said, how'd you he said, look, it took me like 3-4 months to convince my board to buy some Bitcoin. They said, all right, Michael, like how'd you actually get them to buy Bitcoin? He said, it's Bitcoin. I sent them 7 YouTube videos. I sent them like a Palm podcast. I sent them to Blockworks. I was like, oh man, that's only in crypto do you get people to buy like hundreds of millions of dollars worth of an asset class just from a couple of YouTube videos. So,
yeah, I think, you know, at the point where we are with all the content, I think it's so good for onboarding people because, you know, in the past it was pretty much just word of mouth trying to explain it to somebody. And if you had some like nutty person trying to explain to you what Bitcoin is that perhaps didn't like fully grok what was going on, you know, just, oh, it's the next currency of the future, bro. And they're just like, they don't really know anything about what actually makes Bitcoin tick. I think perhaps you would get steered away from it a bit. And I think you had some of that, you know, in the later half of 2017. But yeah, I think where we are now, there's so much content that someone can just get up to speed so quick. I mean, I think personally, like I'm kind of a testament to that where I got into Bitcoin like really heavy in the late summer of last year. And it was just, I got the Bitcoin standard, layered money. And I just, you know, listened to every podcast I could get my hands on. And to be honest, like I'm almost out of major podcasts that I can listen to every day. Cause I would just listen to like all day long. I was working, almost every day. When I wasn't at school. So when I was at work, I had my headphones in just listening to podcasts all day. So I think like if anybody wants to get, a good understanding of Bitcoin, now you can get up to speed so much faster than you would have been able to in the past.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, here's a fun story for you. When Mike and I were launching Blockworks, we were still trying to figure out what all this stuff really meant. There was no Pomp podcast. There's no Peter McCormick's podcast. Like, we didn't have our daily newsletter. We didn't have our podcast. Like, none of this stuff existed. And I remember this one episode. It was Tim Ferriss, Naval Ravikant, and Nick Szabo. Who he doesn't put out much content anymore, but he used to. We sat down. There was like this 3-hour podcast. We sat down. We were roommates at the time. We were living together, and we sat down on the couch. And we would play the podcast for like 10 minutes on speaker. We'd pause it every 10 minutes. We'd be like, "All right, man, did you get that?" He'd be like, "Nah, nah." He's like, "You get that?" I'm like, "Nah." All right. So then we go back and Google it for like an hour, try to understand it, and then we press play again. And that's literally how we first tried to understand this industry.
That's wild. Yeah, I think now you have, like Peter McCormick has said this himself, so I don't feel bad saying this. You know, he asked a lot of the dumb questions, where like very surface level questions, which is great for for new people coming in. Whereas you're talking about like Nick Szabo, Naval, these people are talking at a high level already up here. So it's like you're just trying to take the baby steps, and they're flying. So it's like, you have to catch all the way up to where they're at. So I think now we have a lot of like surface level kind of, I guess you could say like pleb content, where like people coming in for the first time, these podcasts or just content in general that's being put out is very, it's just in layman terms. We also have like Clubhouse and stuff now, which is really cool, where I know a lot of people get orange pilled on Clubhouse, and you could just, casually just, talk to people on the internet, yep. Come in, ask any questions if you want. So, yeah, I think overall, like, the content is just, like, on another level than it ever has been, which I think it's just going to continue that way, and you love to see it.
Yeah, you do love to see it. All right, let's get back to some of the metrics. One of the things I'm curious about is the funding rate. I read one thing that you said. You said, this is a quote, you said, you want to see funding rates drop negative. It's a bad sign if the funding rate skyrockets. Can you just explain like what the funding rate is and why that matters?
Yeah, so in Bitcoin we have this unique futures, I guess you could say, product where it's called the perpetual swap. It's basically this future that doesn't expire, and it allows you to get this crazy amount of leverage that settles instantly. And so all these, when you hear about people getting liquidated, it's all through these perpetual swap contracts on FTX, Binance, these major derivative exchanges. That's where all this is taking place. A lot of it, overseas, obviously, because the U.S. isn't going to let that happen in the U.S. So What's happening there is you have this contract that's pegged to the Bitcoin price, and the way that it's pegged is through the funding rate. So, you know, there's an oracle that kind of takes an aggregate. It's like an index price of all the major exchanges, you know, Coinbase, Kraken, Binance. And so it kind of takes this weighted average of what that price is at the time. And then it to peg that index or oracle price is what it's called, to what they're offering, showing as the perpetual price. They use funding rates. So, you know, if everybody's on one side of the trade, that side of the trade is actually paying every 8 hours a fixed, you know, a rate. I mean, it's changing constantly, but they're paying that to the other side of the trade. So, like, if everybody is long, everybody wants to go long, then longs are going to be paying shorts. And so that when you look at the funding rate, if the funding rate is really positive, it means like sentiment is like permeable, like we're going to the moon, you know, where no corrections ever again, corrections don't exist, and those things going in a vertical line. That's the kind of thinking that it starts to resemble when you just have like super high prolonged funding rates that are positive. So that's a good way to kind of gauge, okay, everybody is super bullish on these trading platforms. And what happens is when everybody takes one side of the trade, it becomes very attractive for a whale to step in and say, okay, you know, everything is super fragile because there's so much leverage. I can just push the price down a little bit and trigger this cascade where, you know, let's say Bitcoin price is at 50,000 and there's a huge liquidation price set at 49,900. So the whale is like, okay, you know, I have a bunch of capital. Let me just market sell a bunch to push the price down. And all they have to do is just get it down to trigger it, hit that stop loss for whoever had it at 49,900. Their stop loss gets triggered, so they sell, or, you know, someone gets liquidated, which is a forced sell. And then that triggers the next person's, and then it becomes this cascade, this avalanche downward. So I think looking at the funding rate, seeing that really high, that's showing that the likelihood of a correction, like the longer that funding rates are high, for like the longer period of time, the higher likelihood you are looking at for a correction. But then vice versa, where, you know, if the funding rates are negative, traders are super bearish, you know, everyone's expecting more downside. So for a whale, you know, you have a lot of shorts, it becomes advantageous for them to step in and push the price up. You know, the same idea, just the other way around, push the price up to trigger someone's stop loss for their short, and then they have to buy in, which triggers the next person's, and then it becomes, yeah. And that's, you know, you think of short squeeze. So I think just looking at the behavior of what the majority of traders are doing, a lot of times that can give you a gauge of, because the people that are making the money, it's like 95% of the traders are getting wrecked, and it's like a very small portion of traders and mostly whales that are profiting. So you don't want to usually follow what the majority of traders are doing.
Are you just buy Bitcoin and hold, or are you trade in the markets?
So I hold, like, I know this is a little sacrilegious, but I have like 95% at a minimum. A lot of times I'll just trade like 1 or 2%, but I always keep at least 95% in my HODL stack, and then I'll play around a little bit just because I like the markets. I think it's like, obviously for most people they just buy hold if they don't want to like do all this like staring at charts, and you know, just buy, hold, whatever. You don't even need to check the price. Just don't look at it for 5-10 years. But if you're interested in that stuff, like me, I just like to keep. I just see it as a game. You know what I mean? Like, just trying to play the markets and like guess the markets. I just see it as kind of, you know, I'm throwing in $100 here and there, and then trying to like make a trade. It's I feel like I'm learning how markets work, and it's kind of a game. So that's the way I take on it. But I don't think I'm like some super experienced trader or anything, which is hence why I keep 95%.
I mean, it's the best. It's the best way to learn, right? Is by dabbling in the markets.
Yeah, I think after you get wrecked.
Yeah, until you get wrecked, right? My my buddy was asking me how, he's sending me all these DeFi articles, you know, Uniswap and all that kind of fun stuff. He's like, you think this stuff is real? Like, you know, can you explain it to me? Like, I'm reading all these articles, I don't understand it. And I was like, yeah, I guarantee you I know why you don't understand it. do you have MetaMask? You ever use Uniswap? He's like, well, no. Like, and I was like, all right, throw $100 in your MetaMask, send it over to Uniswap, try it out.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think, you know, especially like we're just talking about Bitcoin, like coming into Bitcoin, the best way you can learn is, you know, by actually kind of getting hands-on with the protocol yourself, getting a node, playing around with the node, getting my cold card and actually having like build the transactions. Like, I didn't know about any of that stuff because, to be honest, like, I really hyper focus on the price. Like, obviously I understand like the importance of what, you know, Bitcoin changes for society and stuff, but like I feel like my little sliver that I focus on is like kind of the price action and you know behavior of the investors on chain, all that. So I think, you know, just going through that experience of playing around with the, you know, transaction building, I think that was a really big learning experience for me. And I think you're so right. For anybody like trying to learn how Bitcoin works, one of the best ways is probably just to get hands-on with the protocol yourself.
Yeah, totally. All right, man. I got a few more questions here. One of them is, and then we'll wrap this thing up. One of them is, you know, Willy Woo's always talking about NVT, right? And, you know, different ways to value the network of Bitcoin, you know, and ultimately the, you know, to determine the price of Bitcoin. Do you think that there are different value methods, you know, different equations basically to determine the price of Bitcoin outside of just, you know, supply and demand determines price? Are there different equations like NVT?
Yes, but not so like NVT, the you know, what Willie's always posting on Twitter. So there's like the NVT ratio and then there's the NVT price, which is what he's always posting. And so that's like he takes, I think it's like some moving average out of the NVT to determine like an actual price that he can say is, well, let me back this up. So NVT is a very simple ratio. It's the network value, the market cap. And it's a ratio of that to the on-chain transactional volume. So like the whole point of NVT is kind of to be like this PE ratio of Bitcoin, where you know, you can identify where Bitcoin is either overvalued or undervalued based on the underlying transactional activity or investor activity going on the blockchain. So when you get into, you know, the end of the bull market, usually you have this big overheated price compared to the NVT, where there's not a whole lot of on-chain transactional volume, but market cap is blowing out to, you know, the moon. So you have this very distinct like overheated zone. So that was kind of the point of NVT, where, granted, like it's not like people were giving Willie a really hard time for price going under his NVT price. Like, the point of it isn't that it's 100% gonna give you what the price should be at that moment. But all it's saying is whether it's under or overvalued. So like right now, the fact that price is under NVT isn't a bad thing. It's a really good thing, because it would be like if you were looking at a stock and the PE ratio was, you know, the price was way undervalued compared to the earnings of the company. So I think that's the way you look at it. I think that's the only way you can get an absolute price to kind of pinpoint, but there are some other, you know, kind of ratios that you can look at to gauge, you know, if Bitcoin's overheated. Like one good one is NVRV. So that's the market cap to the realized cap. So you're looking at a ratio between market cap and realized cap, which is the capitalization based off of when the coins were moved last. So, for example, you know, Roger Ver, when he bought his Bitcoins at like 50 cents or a dollar, if he bought, you know, 100,000 coins at a dollar, that's $100,000, obviously, that he spent. So it, let's say he has never moved those coins until today, rather than market cap, which, you know, those coins would be worth whatever, like $3.7 billion. But when you're looking at realized cap, it's the actual price based off of when they're last moved. So those 100,000 coins that Roger Ver bought at a dollar, it'd be $3.7 billion added to market cap, but realized cap, it's still only 100,000, because the last time those coins moved was at a dollar. Therefore, it was $100,000. So looking at a ratio of the market cap to realized cap is kind of a good way to gauge, you know, is the marginal buyer and seller blowing the price way out in proportion to what, like, the actual capital flowing in is coming in and, like, buying and setting the price floor at. So you get, like, these very distinct overheated spikes at the end of the cycle, which, by the way, we haven't even come close to hitting. But that's showing you, yeah, like, the marginal buyer and seller are way out of proportion bidding up price compared to what the underlying capital flowing in is saying. And so that's probably a good time to consider, you know, taking some chips off the table.
Nice. What about stock to flow?
I think stock to flow is kind of a good directional gauge. Like, I have a lot of respect for Plan B. I think he's, like, super smart. Obviously, he's been, like, you know, he's been really nice to me and helpful to me. But as far as, like, the model itself, I don't hold a super strong opinion on it. I think it'll be right until it's wrong, obviously. And it's directionally correct where, generally the where he's saying the price will go over time, I think is spot on. And you have that the supply function, which I agree with him. But, you know, he always gives the story of when he created the stock to flow, he's looking for a way to value Bitcoin, and the reason that he bought Bitcoin was because of the scarcity. So that's, like, that's what really drives the price. I think that's a really good point, but you are missing that demand side. So that's the only, and I know he's heard that argument a million times, but that's the only thing that I kind of disagree with a little bit there. But then again, he says, you know, the supply does drive the demand. So I don't know. I don't have a super strong opinion on it. I wouldn't trade it or anything. But directionally, you know, it's just another one of the tools to have in the bag where, you know, stock to flow is saying that we're at peak cycle and it's above that, you know, that line that the dots, you know, kind of fluctuate around. And if it's, like, way above that, then, yeah, we're probably overheated. But I think it's perhaps something to gauge, like, the broader bull bear, you know, are we overheated, maybe time to sell or sell some futures short at the top, or are we, you know, at the bear bottom where maybe it's time to, sell the house and everything you own and accumulate hard because you're probably near the bottom of the cycle. So I think it's just another tool in the back.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, man. So we had 57. I tweeted out, I said, I'm interviewing Will Clemente. I'm interviewing him today to figure out where we are in the market cycle. What do you want to know? We had 57 people comment. 42 of the 57 people said when moon. So I don't know if that says more about your followers, my followers, or just crypto Twitter in general, but I'll translate it for them. And I will. I'll do what Peter made Willie do, which is give a little price prediction. So, where do you think we're going to be at where does this cycle end? You know, I'm not going to say like 12 months, 18 months. Whenever this cycle ends, where do you think the cycle ends at?
Yeah, I think. You know, although this correction is not been so fun in the short term, I think now I'm more bullish on the broader cycle than ever, which seems kind of counterintuitive, but if we can see obviously some more institutions stepping in and price starts to revert the other way, perhaps we get more institutional announcements late summer into the fall. I think, you know, a lot of the coins that have been sold off recently have been speculators, weak hands, if you will. And none of the selling has really come from people with long-term conviction. So I think we're just in this consolidation, perhaps for a few months, perhaps for a few weeks, perhaps maybe we pump by the end of the week. Maybe Bitcoin conference gets us out of this little range that we're in. But I do think now that we've had, and not only just the correction, but, you know, the consolidation before that, we're pretty much going sideways since, 45, 50K. So, long story short, you have a lot of investors that have come in at these levels, so therefore you now have this price floor set at these levels, and I think it gives us a kind of a, I don't want to say launch pad, but that's the only way I can really, like, think of how to describe it, for platform, I guess, for price to grow up off of from here. So I think if anything, that this makes the price structure, granted that we're, you know, going to break out up from here, this will be a really healthy consolidation zone. And so I see that, you know, we still have 300K in the cards for the end of the cycle. I don't know about the end of the year, because I guess it just depends on when we kind of break out of this consolidation. I think like once we're above all-time highs, then obviously it's, you know, off to the races. But for the time being, I think it's hard to gauge about the time. But I think still that 250K, 300K is in the cards for the end of the year. I think 100K yeah. is still like, I don't think that's going to be an
issue.
Yeah,
that's a no-brainer. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, man, I always wrap up with a few questions, and then we can flip the interview. You can finish it up by asking me one question if you want.
All right.
On a more personal note, what's the biggest challenge or like toughest thing you're kind of thinking through these days?
Yeah, so I guess twofold. It's an interesting question. I think first of all, I kind of hit a rock with I was consuming so much content on all this stuff the on chain, where it was like I was listening to every podcast all day long, and there's a fair amount of content, but there's not like a whole lot. So now I struggle to kind of have new stuff to look at. I read, you know, everyone's newsletters, and I'm constantly looking at the charts, but I do like to hear other people's perspectives. So I've been trying to kind of combat that by getting in touch with like other on-chain analysts that are much smarter than me and kind of picking their brains. The other thing, to be honest, is like I'm a very introverted person. So being around, like doing all these interviews and stuff has been interesting for me. Like especially the first interview I did with Pomp, I was like, oh shit, you know, I gotta talk to this dude, all these people are gonna be listening, and like and you know, I was in my head, you know, I get all that, you know, it starts going. So I think like learning how to just ignore that and being like, who cares, like just talk, and you know, nobody cares, that's been good. Something that I've been I guess kind of learning over the past few months, but it's something I still battle with a little bit, just, you know, getting used to kind of the attention and stuff, where it's like I wake up and I'm like, holy cow, I have 90,000, 100,000 followers. I can't shit post anymore. I can't, you know, everything I have to do has to kind of have some substance behind it. But, and also like people are watching. So, you know, if I make a typo, it's like, damn, like, you know, 1,000 people probably just saw I made a typo. Or if I put out something and, you know, it was just dead wrong, you know, there's a lot of eyeballs on me now. So I think I need to be careful with like the price predictions. I made this price prediction that we wouldn't go below 50K, and then you had Elon tweet and you know, all the stuff with China, which I don't know, I think that played a big role in the price drop, but
yeah,
people were giving me hell on Twitter for that. So I learned not to make any more short-term price predictions, but
I saw you apologizing. Like
yeah, I was like I'm sorry, I'll do that again. But just getting used to I guess all the eyeballs has been really weird for me, because I've always been super like introverted.
Nice. All right, man. That's all I got for you. If you want to flip the interview, ask me one question.
Yeah, so I asked Pomp this too, and I had to flip the question around on him. You know, what would you, I guess, for kind of like the younger listeners, what would you kind of give advice to yourself, you know, call it, you know, 18, 20 years old? What would you perhaps have done differently that others could kind of take away? And, you know, what things do you think that you did do well that others can take away as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. Are you talking specifically about folks who are kind of interested in Bitcoin, or you're just saying like 18, 19, 20-year-olds in general?
Yeah, I would just say in general, like, you know, Bitcoin aside, just like being successful, that kind of
yeah.
kind of thing.
I think the biggest thing that you don't realize until you look back is how willing people are to help you when you're 18, 19, 20 years old. And you know, now I'm getting to be almost 30 years old. Like, no one wants to help a 30-year-old dude, right? Like, but you know, but if you're a nice 19, 20-year-old college kid asking for advice, right? And especially if people see that you're a hustler, then, you know, I don't know. I think my advice to everyone would be, to, you know, who's still in college, would be to take advantage of that. And, you know, kind of related to what you were just saying, like, get comfortable putting yourself out there. I can almost guarantee you, like, if 12 months ago I said, yo, Will, like, just start posting charts from Glassnode, like, immerse yourself in this industry, you'll have 100,000 people following you, you would have thought I was crazy, right? But there's a lot of people who, you know, people are hungry for content and for knowledge. And so there's a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-olds who have a different and more unique view on the space, and also transparently and candidly, who understands social media better than most people. And so I would say put yourself out there on social media and like good things will happen. And also like some of my most formative years in college and like right out of school, I was doing cold calling jobs and like sales jobs. And that kind of taught me that like, I don't know, you can kind of DM anyone and email anyone and pick up the phone and call anyone, because the worst thing that happens is that they don't respond to you, right?
Yeah, that's such a good point. Like, as far as Twitter, at least, you know, you can reach out to anybody, and you'd be surprised how, I think, you know, a lot of times people just have their DMs flooded where they can't get to every message. But, you know, everybody that I've interacted with, I think, like, now I've been fortunate with, you know, having a little bit, you know, the following now, where if I reach out to people, people are super helpful. And, you know, I think everyone out there is looking to help others. Just sometimes they only have so much time in the day, and, like, you know, their DMs get flooded. So I think, you know, I think some of them probably wish they could get to everybody, but you're so right. Like, people are very willing to help you out, especially, you know, if you come to them and say, hey, look, you know, like, I value your opinion, I respect what you have to say, you know, what do you think? And odds are, you know, most of the time people are going to say, okay, you respect me enough to, you know, come to me and ask me. So now I kind of feel like that duty to give you a good response. So I think that's kind of like the psychology behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And like, yeah, just say put yourself out there. I don't know if it sounds like you asked the same question to Pomp, but I'm sure Pomp didn't tell you. I don't know what Pomp's response was, but a fun story about Pomp is when it was June 2018, we were trying to get Pomp to speak at an event, and we were still, it was just Mike and me. Like, we had no employees, nothing. We were just hosting conferences or hosting events, like meetups and stuff. And I think we had one employee, this guy Riley Silbert. Shout out Riley. And we were trying to get Pomp to speak at an event, and we emailed him 11 times or 12 times, and he never responded to us. And then on either like the 12th or the 13th time, he goes, guys, if you stop fucking emailing me, I will speak at your event. And that's how we got Pomp. And that's how we ended up linking up with Pomp for the podcast and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it takes 12 that's emails hilarious. Sometimes.
Yeah, I remember, God, I had like 1,500 followers in January, like 2,000, I don't know, something like very low. And I was trying to get in touch with him, because when I first like got into Bitcoin, I was like posting different articles and stuff on Medium, and he kind of like found me through that. This is before I did any of the on-chain stuff, so he was gonna have me on the show to talk about these articles, and so he reached out to me. He's like, "Hey, want to come on the show?" And I was like, yeah, like, of course. And then I just didn't hear anything for like 2-3 weeks, and so like I kept spamming him. I was like, nah, man, like, I'm getting on this damn show. And I just kept messaging him, and finally he messaged me back. He's like, oh, my bad, you know, I'm just busy, and I got a million messages. So yeah, I think like I've learned the power of following up, and even just like annoying someone until the fact that they're like, okay, let me do this, go ahead and do this for you, because if I don't, then you're just gonna keep messaging me, asking me. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm on my eighth Twitter DM to Pat Mahomes. So I'm hoping I've got like maybe one or two more before he responds to come on the show. So shout out Pat Mahomes if you're listening.
There you go.
All right, man. Will, this was an awesome podcast. We'll have to do this again soon. Thanks, man, for coming on.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.